Thanks for tuning in. On this episode, I had the chance to sit down and talk with my friend and fellow peddler, Donna Blau. We talked about her two breast cancer diagnoses. We also talked about her reconstructive nightmare and the plastic surgeon who just blatantly ignored her request. Let's take a listen to what Donna has to share. Welcome to Behind the Pink Ribbon, where we share stories, information, and other content related to breast cancer. My name is Melissa Adams. I am a 12-year genetic breast cancer survivor. I've learned so much through my own journey with breast cancer. I have met some amazing people along the way, many that have become lifelong friends. I have experienced the emotional roller coaster of a breast cancer diagnosis, heartache, anger, frustration, loneliness, and even gratitude. Through this podcast, we will speak to breast cancer survivors, supporters, and healthcare professionals to gain insight and understanding behind the pink ribbon. I'm here with Donna Blau, a 27-year breast cancer survivor from Phoenix, Arizona. And I know Donna from Dragon Boating. We paddled together on the Phoenix Desert Dragons Dragon Boat team. So welcome, Donna.
Thank you.
We appreciate you being here. And we're going to talk a little bit about your breast cancer story. 27 years. first of all, that's fantastic. So, yep. You know, celebration to you on that. So let's talk about, number one, how old were you when you were diagnosed the first time with breast cancer?
I was 40.
40. Okay. And did you have a family at that point in time?
Yes, I had a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Okay.
And so, we were living in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay, so pretty young kiddos at that point in time. Did you find a lump? Did you go in for a mammogram? Did you have a an exam at the gynecologist's office? How did all this come about?
It wasn't a lump. My breast felt warm to the touch and full, more full than my right breast, and it just didn't seem right. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't concerned that it would be cancer because I didn't find a lump, but I went to see, I couldn't get in to see my regular gynecologist, so I saw a nurse practitioner, and she suggested I have a mammogram, so I had that done, and they got the results, and my doctor called and said she needed to see me, and I came in, and they did another test, which was through some secretions from my nipple, and they found that I had DCIS throughout the whole breast.
Okay. So there was no lump, but that DCIS is, so on the mammogram, it looks like speckled white dots, if you will. And so it was just kind of all over.
Through the entire
left breast. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what stage of cancer would that put you at with the DCIS? What did they kind of give you in terms of
stage?
They
didn't say anything like that. They just referred me to a breast surgeon, and she told me that she thought the best thing would be just to remove the breast, but that wasn't necessarily the only thing they could do, and I decided to go with that because I didn't want to take a chance.
Sure.
Since this was, you know, 1992, what if they're wrong? They're telling me it's not going to kill me, but I have little kids.
Right.
So I chose to go more the extreme route to have the breast removed and have reconstruction.
So did you, so let's kind of back up a little bit in terms of having that diagnosis. Is there a family history that you have in terms of breast cancer? So nobody in your family kind of popped up? Okay. So did they kind of give you any indication of anything? Were they concerned about a genetic mutation at all?
Back then, no.
Okay.
They didn't really approach that at that time.
Okay.
So we scheduled the surgery, and I had a saline implant put in because they had recalled the silicone implants.
Okay. So this was back when in the 90s, they were having that conversation about the concerns related to the implants and had pulled them off the market. Okay.
Yep.
So did you opt for a single mastectomy or did you do the bilateral mastectomy?
They weren't offering bilateral back in those days, at least not in Santa Fe, New Mexico. That was never brought up.
Okay.
And I didn't think anything of it. I was of the mindset, just fix it.
Okay.
Just fix it.
So did you have immediate reconstruction at the time of the mastectomy?
They put in tissue expander.
Okay.
And I went through that process and then had the saline implant put in probably towards the end of the year. I can't remember exactly how long it took, but I know my kids were gone for a month when I went through that part of it because it took a time, kind of a lot of time, so...
Okay. And so did they go with family?
Mm-hmm. They went to their grandparents' ranch in Texas.
Okay.
Which they usually would go every summer anyway for a couple of weeks, but they were there a month.
Okay. So that might have been a little bit different for them in terms of the length of time for them
definitely,
to be away.
Definitely.
Okay. And was that hard for you to have them be away, or did you think that that was, you know, better for them? Like, what were your feelings kind of around that?
It was better for them and for me. So,
okay.
They were in good hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just kind of knew that at that time, you know, you kind of needed to be able to take care of yourself. They were really young. So did they understand anything? Did you have a conversation with them?
I don't think they really understood at the time. They were scared.
Sure. Sure. Do you remember, kind of what you said to them? I mean, you said your youngest was three.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have any children, so I can't imagine how you try to conceptualize that information to a three-year-old. So do you remember anything that you said to them?
When they saw me in the hospital, I couldn't speak very well because they had done some damage to my vocal cords, and that scared Katie, the youngest. And we didn't really talk about it. We just talked, you know, I just said that my boobie was sick and I was having it fixed and that I was going to be okay.
Okay.
And that they'd go stay with grandmother and papa.
Yeah.
And then come home.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm glad that you had that support of being able to, you know, send them to their grandparents to be able to, you know, kind of have that space, if you will, for you to recover and do what you needed to do. So you said that they damaged your vocal cords. Was that from the mastectomy that they damaged the vocal cords?
During the surgery.
The surgery.
The anesthesiologist kind of scraped things on the way down. So I had a really gruff sounding voice and that really scared Katie. She couldn't understand why I couldn't talk right. Okay. At least the normal way. She was used to hearing me talk.
Right, right. Okay. So you had the single mastectomy with the reconstruction. Did you have any other course of treatment? Did you have to do chemotherapy or radiation?
No, they didn't recommend either. Since I had the breast removed, I could have gone with radiation and rather than the mastectomy, but, and my breast surgeon let me make that decision. She wasn't going to tell me what she would do in that situation. After the surgery and all was said and done, she told me that she felt I made the best decision by going that route. So I thought, well, I'm fine now and it's going to be okay. I don't have to worry about it. I have perky boobs. It's good. Not realizing it doesn't always work out the way you expect it to.
Right, right. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I do want to ask in terms of, so you said that some of your family was in Texas. Did you have a support system around you in Santa Fe? Did you have any family, any friends?
Oh, lots of friends.
Okay.
Lots of friends.
And so they kind of helped to support you mm-hmm. through this process and just.
Oh, yeah. They took good care of me.
Okay.
It was good.
Okay. And then obviously your husband.
Of course. Yeah. My husband and his family and my family, everybody was really supportive.
Okay.
And I'm sure they were scared because they weren't used to anything like this. And me being so young was surprising.
Right. Right. So, So you kind of got through that and had the surgery, didn't do the chemo or the radiation. So then what came next?
Well, we ended up moving out of state and moved to the East Coast. And while I was there, I had gone to see a doctor because my implant had started creeping up my chest. So it was like getting close to, it was up on my shoulder blade, actually. And my gynecologist actually was, every time I'd have an exam with her, my yearly exam, she would check that breast as well as my natural breast. And she found a lump underneath the implant growing underneath it.
So like on the chest wall?
On the chest wall. And she referred me to a breast surgeon in New York City. And I went and saw this doctor. She was very nice. And it was a team of women, except for the plastic surgeon. And she felt that it was a mucinous carcinoma. So it was slow growing, not all that uncommon, but not as common as DCIS. And because it was slow growing, it was an invasive cancer, but it, you know, they could do something about it. So I thought, great. By then I had enough tummy fat. I figured I could have them do a tramflap reconstruction and use my own tissue so that I wouldn't have to have another implant and worry about it shifting or it leaking or having problems with it, because they do have a shelf life.
So how old were you when this, when you found the lump?
I was 57.
57. Okay. So this is 17 years later mm-hmm. that you found something else.
Yep.
So my guess is, and you know, certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe kind of around that 10-year mark, you were thinking, I'm good. I'm good. I'm, you know, okay. I mean, that's kind of the marker that most people that I know have used. So were you kind of thinking that, or was that earlier for you? Or,
no, I never thought of that. I just figured I was going to be fine. That so nothing. I didn't expect to have breast cancer again.
So immediately after you had the first diagnosis, had the surgery and did all of that stuff, you were immediately like, I'm good. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. Not even a thought.
Didn't even worry about it.
Okay. And then 17 years later, you find a lump.
Yeah. Okay. That was, I was like, wait a minute. How does this happen? I don't have any breast tissue. But, you know, they can't guarantee they get 100% of the tissue.
Right.
So.
Right. So then you have the surgery. And so did they do the reconstruction using your own tissue?
Yes, they did.
Okay. And how did that work? I mean, I would imagine it's a longer recovery.
It was worse than the breast cancer.
Okay. And so why?
The surgery itself was pretty bad. They pretty much do a tummy tuck, which means they cut you from your hip bone to your hip bone.
Okay.
And they take all the fat and muscle and they kind of reroute it up into where they're create a breast with your own tissue in it. It looked really good. It was had a little bit of a divot in it because I didn't have quite enough tummy fat. And he assured me that he could fix that and that wouldn't be a problem. And after the surgery, I had 6.5 weeks of radiation. And I didn't think anything of that. And when I went to see him after the radiation for him to finish the reconstruction, he said he wanted to put in a small implant and create a nipple. And I said, I don't want the nipple. Don't do that. And I was, well, okay with the implant. And he did the surgery. And it probably was maybe not even 2 months after I stopped the radiation treatment. But I figured he knew what he was doing. He's the doctor. He's the one in charge.
So why did you have to have the radiation? Because that wasn't part of the first breast cancer diagnosis. So what came up this time to have them make that recommendation for 6 weeks of radiation?
It was because it was the mucinous carcinoma.
Okay.
So they wanted to do the radiation to make sure that they got everything that they possibly could.
Okay.
So I did that. I was working in New York City, and I would leave at 4 o'clock and go have my treatment for half an hour and get on the bus and go home and take care of the kids. And although my husband did more than I did, he made dinner all the time.
Yeah. But every day for 6 weeks is a long time.
Yeah.
Well, 5 days a week.
And I was fortunate. I didn't have any severe burns, not even a sunburn. And my radiation oncologist was just so surprised how well I did under the radiation and had no adverse side effects. So I was figuring, okay, I'm almost done. I'm not going to have to worry about this again.
But then the plastic surgeon saw something.
Well, no.
Maybe different?
He did the surgery and he actually forgot that I had 6.5 weeks of radiation. And he had written many articles about not doing surgery on irradiated tissue. And I had specifically asked him not to do a nipple. And he did it anyway. And when I came out of surgery, it felt like I had like one of those little things they put in a pizza box so it doesn't squish down.
Oh, yeah.
I had that on my
boobie. Like the little tables that you might use for like your doll set or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was like, why do I have this? And as he's walking away from me, he goes, everything's okay. You're good. You're good. Got a nipple. And he was supposed to lift the other side to make it match. And that didn't happen. And I was like, why am I not sore over here? And I have this pizza box thing. But so when I got home and the next morning took off the bandages, it looked like charred meat, my nipple. It was just like black.
Where did he... Did he use tissue from somewhere else? Did he use the tissue that was there?
From the tissue from the skin.
From the skin that was already a part of the breast.
Yes.
Okay. And that would be probably why it looked charred.
Well, he when I went to see him about it, because I was leaving town for the holidays, he was talking to himself. The nurse wasn't in the room and kept saying, I don't understand this. I don't know why this would have happened. How could this have happened? This shouldn't have happened. And I'm like, why are you saying that? You know I had 6.5 weeks of radiation. And he was like, oh, okay, well, you don't have to pay for anything. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yikes.
And I thought, well, that's kind of weird, but I trusted him and thought, well, he'll fix it. Because that's been my mindset all along. If there's something wrong, just fix it. And it went downhill from there.
So in terms of what was the reasoning to do kind of the hybrid, where it's a combination of the implant and the tissue? What had changed? I mean, he obviously forgot about the fact that you had the radiation. But what was it that made him change his mind at that point in time if the plan was to just use your tissue?
Because I didn't have quite enough fat, so I had a little divot in the breast that, in hindsight, no one would have ever seen.
Okay.
Wouldn't have made a difference. I should have just said no.
Okay.
Hindsight's 20/20.
Okay. So I wasn't connecting. You did say that. So I wasn't necessarily connecting that divot to him then suggesting an implant as part of it, or you know, wanting that. So, okay. So then you're kind of left in this position and he's saying that you don't have to pay for anything. So what kind of happens next? What do you do? I mean, did you go back to see him to have it fixed?
It kept getting worse after I left his office. I went to California for Christmas, and it was separating. The nipple was separating from the tissue, and it looked horrible. And I panicked, so I sent photographs. I sent text pictures saying, "This look what's happening. What do I do? Should I come back to see you?" And he said, "Well, I'm not there. I'm in Florida, so." You'll have to see me when you come back. And I kept sending pictures because it kept getting worse. And so when I got back, I flew in on January 2nd and went to see. He saw me that next day, Sunday, in his office because he knew what it looked like. And he just told me that, you know, it's going to get better. It'll get better. And then it kept getting worse. And it was literally just kind of disintegrating. It was deteriorating, and there was nothing he could do to stop that. But he didn't tell me that. He never really told me what he was going to do to fix it. And I was too freaked out to be saying, what exactly are you going to do? So I just assumed he'd fix it. And I'd go in like every week or so. I developed an infection because of all of that. So I had to go in and have him remove the implant. And he did that in the office.
In the office?
Uh-huh. He did it in the office.
Okay. I'm going to assume that you were under anesthesia.
No.
Oh.
No. He actually made an incision, and when he pulled the implant out, it literally popped like a cork. And then all the pressure was released, and I wasn't as miserable as I had been for the last week before I got back from California.
I think I'm a little dumbfounded right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I have, in fact, I know that I have never heard of somebody having their implant removed in an office and not being under anesthesia.
He probably used a local anesthetic on the breast, but
still.
But it felt like he was pushing down on me and pulling back. Which, because it was really in there, I guess, and because of the infection, it just popped.
I mean, it's under that tissue. I mean, you know, you had the abdominal tissue moved up there, so I imagine the implant would be under all of that tissue, and so.
Well, actually, no, it was above it, because he put it in after the fact, after the tram flap.
Okay.
Was done. So, and then it took probably 7 months for the dying tissue to be cut out of my chest once a week, until finally I listened to my medical oncologist, who said you should see a wound specialist. And I went to see a specialist who also happened to be a plastic surgeon for breast reconstruction. And he told me that he could fix it, but he would have to take my muscle from the back, the latissimus, and bring it around to make a sling and take grafts off my thigh or my bottom. And I was like, no, I'm done.
Yeah. So did the plastic surgeon ever say what happened? Why the skin became charred? Mm-mm. That
he never did. And I finally decided to stop going to him and asked for my medical records, and the records stated the only thing, he never took any pictures while this was going on, never, all his notes said was looking better, getting better, nothing. There was nothing in the notes. And I finally spoke with a friend who was a medical malpractice lawyer, and he listened to what had gone on, and he said, I honestly believe you have a case. So sure. My whole goal was to get it on his record. I didn't want this to happen to anybody else.
Absolutely.
This was probably close to almost the 2-year limit that you have to file. And I ended up having to go back to New York for a deposition. And that was horrendous. Just having to go through it
again. The
emotions that he had, you know, high-powered Park Avenue lawyers, and I told my lawyer after that I wasn't going to, try to take him to court. I wanted to settle, because I didn't feel like I could go through the getting on the stand and testifying. It was just so emotionally upsetting that I said, so long as it's on his record, that's my goal.
Yeah.
It's not about the money. And of course my lawyer said, it's all about the money. And I said, that's not what I'm looking for.
Right.
So, we ended up settling, and it is on his record. And I feel like I, you know, did what I should have done.
Maybe saved somebody else from having to go through that same. I mean, it's number one, traumatic enough that you have one diagnosis of cancer. And then you add on the layer of a second diagnosis. And then you add on the layer of, you know, I opted to do reconstruction because I want whatever it is, you know, it, to kind of feel whole, to just be kind of quote unquote normal, if you will, whatever it might be. And then to have something that traumatizing happen and no explanation. You know, I would imagine that that's pretty, that would be pretty hard to deal with. So I would imagine that you would want to help other people. So I think that that's, you know, I'm sad that you had that experience, but I am certainly grateful that you did what you did in the end to kind of save somebody else from the same thing.
Yeah, that I just was so angry that how could he forget that? How do you forget your patient has had 6.5 weeks of radiation and be the author of, you know, medical articles of what not to do on this tissue that had been irradiated?
Right.
It's like, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, and I think you bring up a really great point. So in terms of seeking out a plastic surgeon, you know, not everybody kind of gets put into a situation where their team already has a plastic surgeon that they work with and they just go there. But being able to research them and ask specific questions, I think that that's always important. But, you know, sometimes you're in that state of, okay, here I am and I trust you and let's just do what we need to do to get this taken care of. So,
well, unfortunately, he was the only doctor that would do that procedure and had hospital rights at the hospital where I was being treated. Wow. So I really didn't have an option of anybody else if I wanted to have that surgery. And I really thought that because I've always been positive about whatever health issues I'm having to deal with, that this would all work out. And it doesn't always.
Right.
And sure. The wound specialist actually described how I look now as a gross disfigurement. And I pretty much have a hole in my chest.
Right.
That healed from the inside out. And it's not a pretty picture, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Not going around topless.
We would still love you all the same if you did. So... so right now there's no implant. You kind of describe it as kind of a hole in your chest. Do you use a prosthesis then?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I do. I wear a prosthesis. And that's, you know, served me fine. They are a little bit warm. So when we're paddling, it gets a little hot and, you know, that's kind of just the way it is. But, I just would not have reconstructive surgery again. Mm-hmm. That's just my personal choice based on my experience.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things that we really want to convey through all of this is that, you know, it's not one way is not right or wrong. You know, it really comes down to a personal decision and what it is that you want for your own body. And, you know, everybody's story is different. You know, we are all impacted by the same disease, but at the end of the day, the stories that are behind that disease and that pink ribbon are so vastly different. You know, and so we do the best that we can. And, you know, unfortunately, there are times when things like this happen, and we hope that they aren't as often. And it just, you know, it leads us to making certain decisions about things that we do or do not want to do.
Yes. So because of that, I am having my right breast removed because of my genetic history and obviously 2-time breast cancer survivor. And I passed the gene on to my oldest daughter.
So I'm going to stop you right here. Okay. I can sense it. So when you had the second diagnosis, they went back and said, okay, now we need to test. Like they were at a different point in time in terms of research, knowing that there's a genetic mutation. So they did test you?
No, not then, because it wasn't until I moved here to Arizona that I, because of the two-time breast cancer incidents, it was suggested that I have my genetic testing done. So I did that. And because I was over the age of 50 when I was first diagnosed, the insurance would cover it. So I went ahead and had it done and found that I had the CHEK2 gene, which is part of the BRCA gene, and which I thought was a little odd. If I knew no one in my family had anything, and now all of a sudden I find I have this gene, and both my daughters have been tested, and only the older one has the gene, and her doctor in New Jersey said she is 65% to 75% chance of developing breast cancer. So her recommendation is that she have a bilateral mastectomy with reconstruction by the time she's 35.
How old is she now?
She'll be 33 in November.
So I know that that's hard. I mean, I could see it, you know, kind of on your face and in your voice. And can we talk real quick about
sure.
what that kind of brings up for you in terms of passing the gene on to your daughter?
Well, that her decision made me decide to get rid of my right breast. And both my girls know I've been proactive and encourage them to be proactive about their health. They know their bodies better than anyone else. And I think it's important to have a positive attitude and be aware, you know, eat right, exercise. Right. And I do a lot of it, and I'm thin, but I'm toned. Right. So, and I feel like that keeps me one step ahead.
Right.
And I pass that on to my girls and anyone else who will listen, because I think it's important to listen to your body and be proactive. It's, you know.
Right. So is she... Does she currently get mammograms at this point in time?
Uh-huh. Okay. She just had an MRI. Both girls are supposed to have mammograms and MRIs once a year. And I know Alex has been doing it. Unfortunately, the very first MRI she had, they found a lump in her breast, in her right breast, back towards under her arm. And that terrified us all.
Sure.
But she had a biopsy done, and it was benign. Okay. So she's fine. And she's on board with having the surgery, and is not. She's not fazed by it. She's, you know, being pretty level-headed about it. So,
So, do you think that for her it might be a little bit? I don't know how to describe this. Do you think maybe it's a little bit easier for her to make that decision because she has the knowledge ahead of time in terms of, okay, I know that I have this genetic mutation. I have this level of risk of developing it. Let me cut that risk down significantly by just having things removed versus let's kind of wait and see. And then a lump kind of appearing and being, you know, most of us who are diagnosed end up kind of in crisis mode, like, okay, what do we do now? So
yeah.
Do you think that that's really kind of helped her?
Oh, I think it has. I think she's made a good decision. That's obviously a decision only she could make. And by her doing that, I finally was, because in my mind, I've had so many surgeries that I didn't want to have another one if I didn't have to. And I thought, well, how stupid am I being? What if I leave my right breast and I clearly have a history and could very well have another bout of breast cancer, and I'm being stupid, not making a decision that three of my doctors had said, you really should consider this.
Right.
And I know they haven't talked to each other about this. It's, and finally when I made the decision, I was relaxed and felt like, whew,
yeah.
That lifted a weight.
Right.
And I'm happy to not have the reconstruction. I will go flat-chested. I don't have to wear bras. That's going to be a good thing.
Flat and fabulous.
Yep.
My friend founded Flat and Fabulous, and, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm good with that. So I'm going to have surgery after our competition in the beginning of August. So it'll be good. And I'll only be out for 4 weeks. So it's all positive.
Yeah. Good. So Alex has children.
Yes.
Married, has children. And
she has Charlie. Charlotte will be 5 in December, and Jack turns 1 on the 4th of July.
Oh, wow.
And they're adorable.
Fun.
Yeah.
So have her doctors talked to her as well in terms of, is she at higher risk for developing potential ovarian cancer? Is that a conversation that
she would be? Yes. But they're not having a conversation right now because of the CHEK2 gene. Yes. You are at a higher risk for ovarian cancer. Quite a number of other things as well. Of course I'm drawing a blank right now.
That's okay.
But she's being proactive.
Good for her.
And that's, I think that's really important for all of us to be proactive when it comes to our health, because if you wait and depend on doctors, you're not going to always be led in the right direction.
Right.
And it could be fatal.
Sure. Absolutely. I think you make a really good point about that, that, you know, you have to be your own best advocate for your own health needs. That's important, because sometimes, you know, we do put our trust in the doctors, and, you know, I, for one, love all of my doctors and I've had a positive experience, but I know that that's not the case for everybody. So, you know, you do really have to be kind of on top of it, you know, to advocate for your own health.
Yeah. And I would suggest to anyone who's newly diagnosed, if you don't feel like you're getting the answers or the questions you might have answered, there's nothing wrong with going to see someone else.
Right.
Because Absolutely. A lot of us feel like, oh, we don't want to insult the doctor, but it's your life.
And, absolutely.
And doctors can make mistakes.
Yes. We're all human.
Yes.
For
so
sure.
It's so important.
Yeah.
Not to, if you have questions, to keep quiet about it. You need to speak up.
Absolutely. I'm going to go ahead and end it there, because I think you really gave some good, solid advice on that. And I want to say thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. And I know that sometimes it's hard and emotional to kind of rehash some things that we've been through. So I appreciate your openness with sharing your story.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I hope to help somebody else.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Pink Ribbon. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you or anyone you know would be interested in sharing your story, please send an email to podcast@behindthepinkribbon.com.
You've been listening to Behind the Pink Ribbon, produced by American Creative Consulting, mixed and mastered at Riverview Podcasting Studios. For more information, please visit designbyacc.com.